Marlena Lieber for Blind Spot, a soon-to-be happening program on ACB Radio. Blind Spot is where we'll talk about no-tech, low-tech kinds of stuff. Andy Warhol once said we'll all get 15 minutes of fame before we die, so I'm offering you yours. You're doing something neat? Can I interview you? Drop me an email to Marlena, M-A-R-L-A-I-N-A, at acbradio.org.
Hello and welcome to Blind Line. I'm Jonathan Mosen. It is Thursday afternoon here in New Zealand, and where I am in sunny Whanganui in New Zealand, it's a beautiful day. Well, this is as good as it gets, you know, radio-wise. We are live, and you never know what's going to happen next. Somebody could ring in and say something really unpredictable, like, you know, wankle rotary engine, and there's nothing that we could do about it. And so hope you'll stay with us over the next 2 hours, because it's unpredictable live internet international radio. And on the program between now and when we finish, we will be speaking in a moment with Brian Hartton, who does the Infotech program on ACB Radio. A very popular program it is as well. You're invited to give Brian a call if you have any questions for him. The number, courtesy of spiderphone.com, is 1-212-812-2800. That's the US number, 1-212-812-2800, and then enter the PIN 1083-4173. That's 1083-4173. And then we'll have an open forum. There are a lot of things that you may want to talk about. If you heard the Jim Layton NLS interview that's been airing on ACB Radio over the last 24 hours, you may want to comment on its contents. NFB have settled out of court with AOL. What does it mean? Was it a victory for either of them? Was it a capitulation for either of them? Those of you who've read the material, let us know what you think about that too in our open forum part of the program, a lot more as well. But now, let us go to the UK, where it is after 2 in the morning as we record this live, and speak with Brian Hartch. And Brian, it's very nice of you to be up at this terrible hour. Thank you for joining us.
Well, it's no problem, Jonathan. I'm really glad to be here, and there's obviously a lot of things that we can talk about, and I'm really glad to be given the opportunity to come on Blind Line.
Well, I think it's really good to have a chat to some of our presenters and to get people to know you all better. Let's start at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about yourself, a bit about your background.
Right, okay. Well, I was born in London. And I was born in September 1970, so that actually makes me 29 at the moment. And I feel really that I've had a very fulfilled life as a blind person so far, and hopefully there's a long way to go yet. And that has included a very varied career, really. But to begin at the beginning, I suppose really I have to thank my parents for my avid interest in technology, because very shortly after I was born, a few months after, for whatever reason, they decided it would be a good idea to purchase a radio cassette recorder. And they actually purchased one of the first stereo radio cassette recorders that was available in this country. It was actually manufactured by Panasonic. And so I spent a good part of my childhood listening to material recorded onto cassette, but primarily the radio, really, because there were so many fascinating things to listen to on there, and I have a great love of music as well, and that's really what started me off on the train of technology, if you like.
Yeah, a lot of us grew up listening to the radio, and I guess that in London at that time, you would have had some interesting things, because that was just after the pirates, and when commercial private radio in Britain was just getting going, stations like Capital Radio and that kind of thing.
Absolutely spot on, Jonathan. Yeah, Capital started in October 1973. It was the second commercial radio station to start in London. I was very interested in those stations, and also the BBC. In 1967, they actually started Radio 1, and obviously it was in its infancy, if you like, in the early 1970s. And I enjoyed listening to the various chart shows and the programs that they had on there. And as I say, it really started my love of music in those days.
You're a bit of a Kenny Everett fan?
Well, yeah, I was very keen on Kenny Everett, and I have quite a collection of archive material that I've recorded myself over the years, and Kenny Everett is certainly among those, because he's been with the BBC and he's been with Capital Radio as well, and he did some excellent programs, he really did.
He was, you know, just listening to the guy, and for those people who are in the industry, it's a fantastic thing to hear. He was just a master. I think the secret to his success was his incredible musical ability as well as his competence as a broadcaster, and you combine
absolutely
those things and all the stuff he did with his jingles and things, it was awesome.
He did some terrific harmony in his jingles, and also he must have been a really good tape engineer, because some of the stuff he actually did produce was so creative.
Yeah, it's good stuff, all right. And so did you take a university education before you went into employment?
No, actually I was I was really educated in a specialist, various specialist schools for the visually impaired, and then I went on to further education college, at, which was also geared to visually impaired people. But when I was at high school, if you like, there was a noteworthy point to mention there, because we actually started, there was a group of us, and I was 15 at the time, and we actually started a tape magazine. There weren't many of them around then, I have to say. The market here in the UK is saturated with talking newspapers and magazines now. But this was purely a magazine for distribution around the school, and it was actually produced on a monthly basis, and it was either 2 or 3 hours long. And it just contained items of interest and music and that kind of thing. But it was a bit of a nightmare to put together, because I had to go home on the Friday night. I was residential there at the school in the week. Edit it and make multiple copies of it in real time, because there was no fast duplicating equipment that I had, and go back on the Sunday afternoon. It was quite a mammoth operation. But, you know, It really was the start of my involvement with cassette magazines for visually impaired people, and all the audio production work that I'm involved with now.
So how did that develop? Was the work that you did for that cassette magazine a foot in the door for you? Did people take notice of the work that you were doing, and it went from there?
Well, yeah, it seemed to work like that. When I went on to further education college, the whole project really expanded, and we started sending it out to people across the United Kingdom, and it actually became quite popular. And that magazine was still in production throughout my 3 years of further education. And then I went into employment, And the magazine folded then, so I actually shelved my interest, if you like, in tape magazines for a few years, and until I took another job, which I'll tell you about it in a moment. What happened then, as far as employment was concerned, was that when I was about to leave further education college, the Royal National Institute for the Blind, which are one of the prominent organisations for us here in the UK, they were about to open a new production and distribution centre, offering people advice about equipment and selling their own range of products. And they had a whole variety of jobs going. And I decided that I'd really like to be telling people about, blind people about the equipment that was available. And so I actually applied for one or two customer services jobs, and unfortunately got knocked back, which I think was very disappointing, and perhaps the RNIB have missed out on, a good advisor of specialist equipment in that regard.
Quite right.
But nevertheless, sorry?
I was going to say quite right too, I'm sure they have.
Thank you. What they did offer me was a job as Braille proofreader. Okay, so this was correcting all the mistakes that the sighted transcribers had made in books and magazines and exam papers and so on. So I needed a job anyway at the end of the day, so I took that and worked at it for a couple of years. But quite obviously it wasn't what I was interested in. And so I started working then. A job came up here in the north of the country, and it was with a national organisation, a charity, albeit small, called the Disability Network. And I took on the role of their services manager for the blind. And that involved there were three strands to that job, really. The main one was advising people about social security benefits that they might be entitled to. Now, this was a really complex area, one which I'd not really had too much experience in before, but I do learn very quickly. And really, it involved filling in very complex benefit claim forms and also representing visually impaired people on a national level at often complex tribunal hearings and even higher than that in some instances. So this was, you know, a case of filling in forms and travelling all over the country and providing good, strong advocacy. And this really interested me. This is something I'd never really thought about before, but, you know, it really did interest me, and I've kind of been hooked on it ever since, really. So that was the first part of it. The second strand of the job was transcribing material from print onto cassette for companies. There were some companies who were providing perhaps adaptive technology, for example, that where the actual instruction manuals and tutorials and so on were not available on cassette. They were generally distributed in large print. So I went to these people and said, well, you know, how about it? How about me as a blind person demonstrating some of your products? And it's a much better way for blind people to learn how to use them. So that's how that got started.
And did it kind of come on from that process of demonstrating equipment and things?
Well, it did, because the third part of it really was producing cassette magazines. And this is where how Infotech got started, because a friend of mine and I were, this was back in 1995, we were discussing specialist equipment. We were both very, very fond of it. And we were saying, well, okay, there are magazines available where suppliers can advertise the equipment they have for sale specifically, and they can say what they want to say, but there was nothing independent at all. There were no visually impaired people saying, well, this is a really good product to buy because, or there was no one saying, well, there are disadvantages to a particular piece of screen reading software, or even a simple device like a clock, watch, or calculator, or anything like that. So we decided we'd actually give this a go. And this is really how Infotech came into being. We put a pilot magazine together, and it had a few in-depth features on it. And the first article that we included was, well, okay, this technology is really quite expensive. How are people going to pay for it? So we looked at grant-making organizations and all that kind of thing. And honestly, Jonathan, it just took off overnight. It took off way beyond our expectations. The RNIB gave us quite a bit of support in terms of publicity, and various other organizations did as well. And, you know, it was just tremendous, the response that we got.
It must be quite a major undertaking to produce a magazine of this kind, not only technically speaking, and I know that you set very high technical standards, but also in terms of becoming familiar enough with this technology and the different products that you look at to be able to give an informed evaluation of them.
Well, we do try our best. We did set down some guidelines, first of all, and we've stayed with those on the whole. We do accept reviews from listeners. Okay, if anyone wants to send in a review, we're quite happy to, well, it's just me now, I'm quite happy to consider it for inclusion within InfoTech, but obviously it does have to be of a certain quality, not only technically, but also perhaps in terms of the content. It certainly does have to contain a current price, and also perhaps a model number, and but certainly the supplier as well. But yeah, it it does take quite a lot of work actually to evaluate the goods. You've got a point there, because when we started out, it was mainly products that we were familiar with that we were reviewing, products that we actually had. We had quite a lot of up-to-date technical equipment that we could review, but obviously we had to do quite a lot of forward planning, and we were running out of ideas fairly fast. So that's when we started to hopefully encourage suppliers to lend us equipment, and I've got to say that a lot of suppliers have actually been very good, particularly in recent years, and certainly in recent months. The quality of the products that we're reviewing now is very good, but generally we only have them for about probably about 7 to 14 days. Okay, so what I've got to do in that instance is really to get the product out of the box, play around with it for perhaps a couple of hours, and then decide what I'm going to do with this. Am I going to script an article and read it out, which is what I do a lot of the time, or am I going to just give a live demonstration of it? And all those things have to be taken into account, and you have to obviously make it into a realistic time frame as well, so that people's attention span isn't going to wander.
And have you ever been in a situation where you've evaluated something, learned how to use it, reviewed it, and then decided, I just can't live without it, so I'm not going to send this back to the supplier, I'm going to buy it instead?
Well, fairly frequently, actually. The Victor was a case in point, but unfortunately, you know, because it was such an expensive piece of equipment, you know, I felt obliged to return it. But a lot of companies, they do say, especially when there's software involved, they do say, well, you know, you feel free to keep it, which is really nice. And obviously, it does mean that perhaps when updates become available, you know, we can let people know about those. And I'm already familiar with the technology involved there, so that the reviews don't take as long.
How do you avoid capture? I mean, what assurance do people have that the reviews that you're doing are genuinely based on what you think of them, if you see what I'm saying? It's a danger that any reviewer faces, I suppose.
Well, I just try to present the facts as I see them, really. I've had quite a bit of experience of technology, obviously, and people seem to have come to respect my reviews, and there's a lot of firm evidence now in written documentation, which I've been keeping, obviously, to suggest that people are being influenced in terms of their choice of purchase when they're actually listening to InfoTech. It is playing quite a large part in their lives now. And I have to say, I've had recent comments that since InfoTech has been on ACB radio, people actually been looking on your site, and they've been saying, well, has Brian Hartgen reviewed this particular piece of equipment? And they have a look down the list, which is what's so nice about it, because the review titles are there. And so that's how it's been, really. And I've had, you know, as I say, quite a lot of letters from people where we've actually influenced their choice of purchase.
And what's the process for recording and distributing this thing? Because I suppose you must have, if you do it at home, you'd have a whole room decked out for this, wouldn't you?
I do, that's right. I have to say that InfoTech is actually, the distributors of it are still the Disability Advice and Welfare Network. I don't work for them anymore, but they actually contract me to produce the program, because I obviously do a lot of other contract work that perhaps we could talk about. But they are the distributors of it, and I believe it's actually sent out to around about 1,000 people on cassette. And obviously the number of people that are listening to it is now enhanced by it being on the ACB radio website. Now they have a whole bank of copies, obviously, in that they distribute them and send them out in returnable postal wallets. And if people want to provide feedback, which we're always grateful for, they can put a message on their cassette when they return it, and they get passed on to me. And also articles are sent in that way. Sorry, go on, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say that you don't have to be involved in the distribution channels, which is a nice thing, because the whole process of duplication and mailing is incredibly labour-intensive, isn't it?
It is, actually. Enough of it here, and because we have our own copiers. Copy all the material I produce for companies at the moment. But yeah, it is a very labour-intensive thing. And you have to, it's not just a case of copying the tapes. You have to do, obviously, quite a lot of quality control to make sure that both side one and side two of the cassettes are okay and evenly balanced and all that kind of thing. In terms of the recording equipment that I actually have, again, I've got quite a lot of that. I started using mini disc about 4 years ago when it sort of first came onto the market, and I was very impressed with its capabilities and the sound quality. So I have three mini disc recorders now, but obviously that now that I'm using SoundForge, that has really partially made the mini disc redundant as far as I'm concerned, and certainly as far as the production of that magazine is concerned, because it's much easier to put it together on the computer, and also it's so accessible as well, which is the beauty of the whole thing. But also have a sound mixer in which you can feed up to 12 auxiliary inputs, and also two microphones you can put in there. And I have various cassette decks and record decks and CD players, and even a video recorder I've stored a lot of the old stuff on, because actually video does provide an excellent sound quality, in actual fact, particularly in stereo. So a lot of the old magazines are stored on videotape. So there's quite an array of equipment in there, and it's not too big a room either, unfortunately.
Minidisc is an interesting technology. It kind of came onto the market with a bit of a splash, and then, I don't know, it didn't seem to take off. And I noticed that in the last year or so, it's come into its own again. There seems to be renewed interest in it. Have you found a means of interfacing your Minidisc recorder to the PC so that you can dump stuff onto your hard disk and use it in SoundForge or anything like that?
Not directly, apart from obviously linking it via the sound mixer, which is what I actually do at the moment. Mm. I mean, it would be nice if you can actually, properly edit things on the mini disc recorder, and you actually knew that it was going to be what you wanted, because you can never quite guarantee it. Because if you're totally blind, as you and I are. Obviously, you can appreciate that you just can't see the visual display. You never quite know whether you've edited a track correctly or not. I've become quite adept at counting the number of menu options and so on, so that I can get it, almost spot on, really. But there's always this uncertainty and panic that you might have edited something out that you didn't mean to.
Yes, it's incredibly nerve-wracking. Actually, this came up when we were speaking to the sound people, specifically Jay, who was one of the people working at the ACB convention on the sound, and we were getting the feed from them. And we had Mike Duke, who was in charge of the mini discs. Very nice. They could connect a PC keyboard to them and control the mini disc player and recorder that way through a PC keyboard. But of course, as you rightly say, with something as absolutely critical as making sure that the convention is recorded, despite the fact that you've been through the sequence thousands of times, you still have this nagging doubt in the back of your mind, am I actually recording this or not?
or particularly for an interview, to be honest, I just wouldn't trust it, not completely. When I know that I've only got one chance of it, I wouldn't do it. And even if you could actually connect the mini disc recorder to a computer in some way for total access, you've obviously got a problem like when you're at an exhibition, for instance, and you're making recordings, and you're using a portable mini disc recorder, you've still got the same access problems. I still don't absolutely know whether I trust it or not.
Yes, I share your sentiments in the sense that I took my mini disc for its first really important tour of duty around the exhibit hall at the ACB convention, and I was mighty glad to get home and find it was all there.
That's good.
Now, you do some contract work, you were saying, with all of this audio stuff. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. Well, let's stay for a little minute with the Disability Advice and Welfare Network, because as well as contracting me to produce the Infotech, they also contract me to produce a certain amount of computer tutorials. We found actually from the research that we did that there was really nothing in terms of tutorials within the United Kingdom for visually impaired people to learn how to use computing, and the training is actually very expensive. If you want one-to-one training, you know, you're talking probably about £250 to £300 a day plus travel. Now that might be it's a bit too early to quite work out in the morning, but it's probably about $550, something like that. So it's actually quite a lot. Particularly when a lot of blind people are on low incomes. So they approached me and asked me whether I'd do some tutorials. And again, they've been really, really successful. And I've been asked to do more. We started with one, and it was on two cassettes. And that took it from the perspective, well, okay, I bought a computer. What do I do with it now? So it covered, like, the keyboard layout, switching a computer on, what you would expect to happen when Windows loads, and some basic word processing. And then the second two tapes went on to more advanced features of Windows. And I've done one on Word as well, which was six cassettes.
That's interesting. I guess expect the unexpected is what I would advise people when you turn Windows on. But it's interesting. When you say that you've done these tutorials, does that indicate, given the wealth of tutorial-type information available from the US, and I have detected this in the past too, that there is some reluctance on the part of the American audience, the British audience, to purchase some American material, that some people just do not like the accent?
I think it goes both ways, actually, Jonathan. I've had the comment that when I've produced material for companies in the past, I've had people from the US writing to me by email and saying, well, it's very good, but we'd like to produce their own material because you have a British accent. So, yeah, I find that really interesting, and you're not the first to raise that point. But... yeah, I think that, I mean, obviously Infotech has stood me in good stead, and as I've said, people have come to respect the reviews that I've carried out in the past. So, you know, obviously the next step really was the tutorial cassettes. And I must say that I've personally actually gone through a lot of the American tutorials, and I think they're very, very good. Dean Martino, a great fan of. I think his tutorials are great, and I love the Sound Computing magazine every couple of months. I'm always checking out the website to see when that's going to be about next. But, yeah, I think there's a lot in what you say. I think that people do like a local environment to work in.
Yes, it's amazing. I'm still on ACB radio when you think about it. But when I was in New York, I was absolutely startled that that we were watching the telly. Well, I wasn't watching it. The children were watching the Teletubbies on PBS. And would you believe that in the US they have overdubbed the soundtrack of the Teletubbies with American voices?
Yeah, I've heard about that. Yeah, it's really strange, isn't it?
It's bizarre.
So, So those are the tutorials, and there'll be one on the internet, you know, really quite soon. I try not to be screen reader specific. And in order to try and balance things, because I do demonstrate the topics that I'm working through so that people get a good idea, I use three screen readers, and they're not the three perhaps that I think are the best, they're just the three that I happen to have on my computer at the moment. They are JAWS for Windows, Window Eyes, and HAL for Windows.
Yeah, so you'd have to use HAL in the UK, wouldn't you? Because it seems to have quite a large market share.
It does, actually, yeah. some companies here in the UK, there are certain screen readers that are very heavily marketed and strongly marketed, and HAL is certainly one of those. And there are a lot of things that I actually quite like about HAL for Windows, and I'm glad that I am in the fortunate position in being able to have, you know, three screen readers on my computer, because I can there are some things I like about each different screen reader, so I can pick and choose to some extent.
When you do your one on the internet, though, it's going to be very difficult to cover all screen readers, isn't it? Because it seems to me that screen readers are now becoming more than just programs that read the screen in a purest sense of the word. They're actually becoming, in the case of the internet, for example, the web interfaces to the HTML. And so the command structure is incredibly proprietary these days.
That's absolutely right, and that one's going to have to, you know, be thought through very carefully, because really haven't quite got to it yet. Because with the Site Village exhibition only last week, which is our major exhibition in the UK, I've been run off my feet with all this work. But yeah, it will have to be thought through very carefully, and I'm not quite sure how we'll do it, but yet screen readers are becoming full of features, really, for the internet. There's a lot of advantages, particularly with MSAA. A lot of blind people have got access to the internet, especially over recent months, that they've never had before. So yeah, that's really good, and I think they'll all be up to a certain level very soon, all those three screen readers, if they're not already.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Brian Hartgen, who hosts the Infotech program on ACB Radio, and it's also, of course, a cassette-based magazine in Britain. If you haven't heard Infotech, well, you don't know what you're missing. It's on Thursday night at 9 Eastern. That's 1 o'clock GMT on Friday morning, and there's another exciting one happening tomorrow. Brian, of course, you have interests outside of technology, and you touched briefly on the advocacy type work that that you are considering. How would you rate the quality of life for blind people in the UK in terms of social security, opportunity to get the technology they need to succeed in society?
Well, that's a very broad area. Let's start with the social security benefit system. As I've said earlier, most visually impaired people are actually unemployed, so the benefits is really important to them. We have something here, the main benefit that visually impaired people can claim, irrespective of whether they actually work or not, is called disability living allowance. And that's divided into two components. There's the mobility component for help with getting around, and there's the care component required for everyday living. If you need assistance, as we all do as blind people, whether we like it or not, we all rely on sighted people to some extent, and that is the government's way, if you like, of providing the assistance that we need in financial terms. Now, it's not an automatic entitlement, and this is a really tricky issue. If you're a registered blind person, or partially sighted for that matter, you're not automatically entitled to receive BLA at either component. You have to go through a very lengthy application procedure, and it's actually very difficult, and I would always encourage people to seek advice and not to fill the forms in themselves unless they're absolutely sure that they know how to put the claim over. Because it is a case of breaking every activity down into the kind of help that you actually need. Because the people actually doing the adjudication, the decision making, they are not, as far as I'm aware, visually impaired, for instance. So they're not going to really have much of an understanding of what it's like to live with a visually impaired person or to be one. And this is the problem, and this is why a lot of cases actually end up at tribunal levels, where you have a legally qualified person, a GP, and also a person who is experienced in the needs of disabled people. And they're the three people that make up the tribunal, and you have to put your case to them as to why you should get disability living allowance. For a lot of people, Jonathan, it's a very emotional and a long, drawn-out task to actually get a benefit that they should be entitled to as a blind or partially sighted person. And particularly in the field that I'm working in now, which is with visually impaired children, the parents do find it a real struggle and very upsetting at times.
Has it always been that way? Was there a time, like in New Zealand and Australia, where you could receive an allowance to compensate you for your costs of blindness and one didn't have to go through those hoops?
Prior to 1992, Jonathan, it was even worse. Okay, it was called attendance allowance, and there were very few people who were blind, and I would say probably no one who was partially sighted, unless you had other disabilities, that could actually get attendance allowance. It was really a bit of a nightmare. So things have improved greatly. I don't want to be too negative about it, because things have improved a lot over the last 8 or 9 years or so, but it still is a very difficult benefit to get.
Of course, the world has changed a lot in Britain with New Labour, and I recall when I was over in Britain briefly at the end of 1998 that Tony Blair's government was going through a series of pretty controversial welfare reforms. What became of those and what effect have they had?
Well, we have had various changes to social security benefits, that mainly the other benefits that people who are unemployed are entitled to, and we will see the abolition of one of those benefits actually next year, so it's important that people actually claim now. And this really takes me on to employment, because we do have a very good system of supporting visually impaired people within employment. Now, I know if anyone actually is listening to this from the United Kingdom, I shouldn't think it'd be this morning, but mainly perhaps in the archive, they'll probably say, oh, no, that's not actually the case. Because so many people, apparently, have had so many bad experiences with our Access to Work scheme, which is designed to help visually impaired people in employment. But when I outline to you now what it actually does, I think, you know, a lot of people in other countries will be pleasantly surprised, and I've got nothing but good things to say about the Access to Work scheme. What it enables a blind person to do, really, is it bridges the gap with things you may have difficulty with in employment. So, for example, if you need a note taker, such as a braille light or braille note, something of that nature, or you need a screen reading package or a braille display, anything high tech really, or it could be a low tech item. It could be a variable speed tape recorder like an APH, or it could be a telephone with a headset on, so you've got your hands free. Those kinds of things can be provided under Access to Work, providing you can justify the fact that you actually need those, and you do get an assessment when you start a job to determine what sort of help you need. But it is, you know, that's quite a good system, and if necessary, you could also advocate that you would need, for example, your own computer, because as I'm sure you know, it's often not a good situation to be in if you've got other people, sighted people, who are using the computer in the workplace, and you as a blind person have got to use the same machine. That could be very difficult. And as a blind person, you shouldn't really have to queue for a computer, because you need it for all sorts of note-taking reasons. So, you know, a computer could be purchased if that was necessary. And the other core component of this is what we call support work. And you can actually have paid for you by the Access to Work scheme a support worker for a certain number of hours to actually work with you to do some of the admin tasks that you as a blind person wouldn't be able to do. So for example, I have a support worker and who perhaps drives me around to places that I can't get to by train, who does the filing, who fills in the disability living allowance forms that I was telling you about, and as I say, all the correspondence that I can't on the computer, that person is able to do. So I think that's a really good system, the Access to Work scheme.
That's interesting. Let me take you back to the technology component of that and ask you about Braille, because often in these sorts of schemes we hear stories about people who can work with speech, but they would be much more efficient if they had Braille access as well, if they could have access to a Braille display. What sort of attitude in general does that scheme take to somebody who's a speech user having additional functionality through Braille?
I think that the scheme itself would think, well, if there's any way that the tasks could be done more efficiently, and if the person is a good Braille reader, and it's going to really make them efficient, then they would purchase that. There's really, I don't think, any question about it. If the need is there, and the need can be justified, then I'm sure that the scheme would do all they could to provide you with a Braille display. I have a Power Braille 40 cell Braille display, but I also have a Braille light 40, because I need that obviously because I do a lot of extensive travel. So the need is certainly there in my case, and I'm sure that's the case with a lot of other blind people, and they're quite willing to provide access to Braille if that's required.
And are those who are making the decisions about a person's need appropriately qualified to assess that need?
Well, certainly in our region, I can't comment for the whole of the United Kingdom, because I live in the northwest of England. Certainly in our region, a lot of it is actually conducted, the assessments are conducted by the RNIB. We have an employment office here in Liverpool, and they serve a good portion of the northwest of the country. So what happens is the blind person rings up and says, okay, I've just got a job, what are you going to do to help me? And invariably the RNIB will end up doing an assessment to determine what sort of assistance is required for a blind or partially sighted person. I have to say that I was able to justify my own technology needs because obviously, you know, having had quite a bit of experience in it. I've always had a good relationship with the Access to Work scheme, and I've been able to do that. But generally, that's what actually happened.
So why are some of your compatriots less complimentary about the scheme than you are?
Well, maybe it's because they haven't had the right kinds of assessments. I think the service may be a little inconsistent throughout other parts of the country, and they may not have had quite the assessments that they were hoping for, or maybe it's a training issue. I'm not sure, but complaints do arise from time to time, and I think the whole scheme is undergoing a review at the moment. I've been asked to participate in an independent survey to determine whether the scheme is good or not, and there are lots of other blind people who are being asked the same the same questions, but I think that's maybe what it's due to.
Do you have to have a job in place before you can access the scheme? Because I suppose one of the dilemmas is that a lot of people find it difficult to acquire the skills that they need in order to be work ready.
That's quite right. You can't access the Access to Work scheme unless you're actually in employment. There are other avenues you can go down, though, if you want to learn more about computing. For example, there are quite a few grant-making organisations, and they can assist you with funding to purchase a computer and or the screen access software as well. That is a long, hard struggle, though, to actually get the funding, but, you know, it can be done. There are student support services. The RNIB, for example, run one of those, and I believe they can give you some support and lend you equipment. But what are frequently becoming available now are obviously colleges that have screen reading software on their computers, and also there are centres, rehabilitation centres, for example, that can provide information technology training. So there are quite a few avenues open to people, and further education colleges as well that are specialist to visually impaired people. So it's hoped that perhaps in the near future, blind people will become more adept at gaining employment. But there's another issue too here, Jonathan, and that is the barriers that are put up about blindness. Obviously, employers themselves are going to have prejudices about what blind people can do and what they can't do. And how you get away from those prejudices, I'm not really sure, apart from visual awareness training and companies and organisations for blind or partially sighted people going out there to employers to potential employers and perhaps demonstrating what visually impaired people can do. And there's a final strand to it as well, I think, and that is that visually impaired people have got to learn things like self-help skills, and by that really what I mean is to dress appropriately for employment and all that kind of thing, because that's all part of it, as I'm sure everyone appreciates, about going into job interviews and looking presentable, and not just for the interview but actually while you're in employment as well. And this will encourage other employers surely to take on other blind people. Although all the work that I carried out within my career has been in the field of visual impairment, I would say that 99% of the colleagues that I've worked with are fully sighted, and they obviously expect certain standards, and we as visually impaired people have to work extra hard in order to maintain those standards and even improve on them.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Brian Hartchin, and if you'd like to speak with Brian, you're welcome to phone in at any time. Our number, courtesy of spiderphone.com, is 1-212-812-2800. That's a New York number. That's 1-212-812-2800. And when you're invited to enter a PIN, that should be 1-0-8-3-4-1-7-3. That PIN is 1-0-8-3-4-1-7-3. I see that we have a lot of people listening, so you've obviously got them spellbound, Brian. I just thought that I'd ask you about the
either that or the fallen asleep.
Yeah. I thought I'd ask you about the question of attitudes towards blindness again. You just referred to that. One of the debates that we're having, and I believe it's already sort of been and gone to some extent in the UK, is that your blindness, your primary blindness agency, the RNIB, has gotten involved in the prevention of blindness, I understand, that the promotion of, you know, safe eye practices and that kind of thing, and there has been some criticism that an agency for the blind should not be, on the one hand, saying it's okay to be blind, and on the other saying don't do this or you'll go blind. Has it been a controversial matter?
No, I don't think it has really. In fact, I've never heard of that being advocated over here at all. I've heard that it's being advocated in terms of web design and web accessibility and that kind of thing, and we can talk about that if you want, but I've never heard of that particular attitude being advocated, no.
That's interesting. So you're saying that people don't have a problem with the RNAB being involved in prevention?
No, I think it's, I mean, if you can prevent visual impairment, then that's obviously very good, I would have thought. I mean, other people may feel differently about it, but I've never heard of it being advocated at all.
That's interesting. It's certainly here in New Zealand a raging battle, but that's interesting. We have a call on the line, and they've come up as unknown number three, so we'll say hello to you.
Hi, Jonathan. It's Maureen.
Hello, Maureen. Nice to hear from you. And you have a question for Brian.
Yes, I certainly do. This interests me very much, and thank you, Brian, for coming on the show. I had almost at one point moved to Great Britain and might still be considering that in the future. So this is of great interest to me. I wanted to have you talk some more, if you could, about the role that the RNIB is playing. I'm wondering if it represents a voice of advocacy, or I'm a little bit concerned about an organization speaking for the blind and having that much control over assessments and what blindness services are like. Do you see the RNIB as helping the issues of blindness, or hurting it, or how do you evaluate it?
Okay, thanks for that. It's a very interesting question. The RNIB are certainly a large organization in this country in terms of visual impairment. I don't think they're the largest. I think the Guide Dogs for the Blind Association is perhaps the larger and perhaps have more money than the RNIB do. And they certainly are involved with a lot of services. They're involved with education, employment. They're getting very much into the technology market now, and that's only happened within the last year or two. They're into Braille, into most things really. But we do have other organisations. It wouldn't be good if the RNIB had a sole monopoly on blindness, if you like, in the UK. That would be terrible. So we do have other organisations that are, very proactive in terms of advocacy on lots of issues. One that springs to mind is the National Federation of the Blind. They're mainly made up of local branches within the UK, and they generally campaign on local issues, but there is a national committee as well, I believe. I'm not a member of them, but that they do have a conference once a year, and obviously there are lots of issues which they feel very, very strongly about, and they have had some very successful campaigns in the past, the National Federation. So that's one organisation. There's Action for Blind People. They provide a lot of services in terms of employment and training and benefit rights, that kind of thing. We have the Talking Newspaper Association of the United Kingdom as well, which is again quite a recent acquisition, if you like. It's only been in place for about 16 years, I think. But they produce a whole variety of magazines on tape and on CD and over the internet and all the rest of it. We have those. We have the Guide Dogs for the Blind. So to answer your question, really, there are a whole load of organisations, really, that are helping to support blind people. And what I also must say is that a lot of those organisations, thankfully now, are employing visually impaired people, especially to do the advocacy work, because I think that's really important. I don't know really quite how sighted people can do some of the advocacy that they do if they haven't either lived with the condition of being visually impaired, or if they haven't had a visual impairment themselves. I don't see how they could advocate certain points with the same effectiveness as someone who's visually impaired. I think the secret of my success as an advocate has been the fact that I'm totally blind, and that's it, really. Does that answer your question?
Definitely. Jonathan, could I ask another question?
By all means.
Thanks. We've talked about services, but what I want to ask is, in your daily life, do you feel that you have a lot of control over your life? Are you able to get around well? Are you able to, you know, what's the attitude like of the general public, like getting help in stores, for instance, doing shopping, the daily things that we all need to do? What's life like and where you
right. Well, I think, again, it's that action from different people. People have, you know, very different experiences, particularly in terms of shopping and mobility, that kind of thing. Speaking personally, I happen to think that I have very good mobility, and in view of the fact that I'm on a train most days, because I have to cover the whole of the north of England representing children with a visual impairment and their educational and benefit requirements, you know, most days are actually spent on the train, so I get lots of help from the people at the various railway stations. I also have a guide dog who gives me, you know, really good mobility. I was using a long cane for most of my adult life, really, up until about a year or two ago. And I really did think that a guide dog would provide me with efficient mobility. And indeed, that has definitely proved to be the case. And we run everywhere rather than walk. yeah, people's attitude generally is very good. Some people are a little bit patronizing, very patronizing in some instances. I was at a hotel, for instance, over the weekend, and I think a lot of sighted people think that you as a blind person, if you're blind, you have other disabilities as well. Okay, so they think that you have a hearing loss, for instance, mm-hmm. and start shouting. that certainly happened to me over the weekend, and people will say, you know, perhaps, watch the plate, it's extremely hot. Well, you would have expected it to be hot, you know, had it just come out of the kitchen or whatever. But generally, the public are really quite helpful, I think. But again, it's a situation that goes both ways, I think. If a blind person is rude or aggressive to a member of the public, then obviously you expect to get the same back. But I think the more visual awareness training that goes on, and there is a lot of it going on over here now, to educate the public, then the better that's going to be. One thing I must say, though, is that the best way, I think, of educating the public about visual impairment is through the television, particularly at prime time TV, when everybody's actually watching, because everyone has the television on, even if it's on only in the background. You know, so many sighted people have the TV on, and I think sometimes I really sit here and wonder, the RNIB and organisations like it have been going for, you know, over 100 years. You know, why on earth haven't they actually got themselves on TV in prime time and started talking about visual impairment? I can't understand what's going on and why that hasn't actually happened, because I think it ought to happen. And it obviously goes without saying, but it needs visually impaired people themselves to do it. And it needs to be portrayed in all manner of situations. There are people like myself who are in employment, but there are people who are not so fortunate, but they still need help within stores or wherever it may be. The other thing that we've had recently is the Disability Discrimination Act. Okay. And this provides you with an equal service to a seeing individual. Now, there are certain parts of this act which affect things like transport or education, etc. But there is part three, which is access to goods, facilities and services, and this came into effect last October. And what this encourages or provides a legal obligation to stores is that they need to provide material in an accessible format. Now, it can't be a chosen format, okay? It must be at least perhaps one format. So if a store were to provide its leaflets on tape, then that perhaps could be acceptable. If a restaurant were to provide Braille menus, that would be a really good idea. And the whole issue of access has kind of taken off in terms of providing things in accessible formats. And this is obviously, you know, really good news for us.
Yes. Well, see, all you need is the BBC to come up with a nice, creative new sitcom.
Well, it's interesting you say that because a while ago in The Archers, Marjorie Angevis had a bit of a cataract problem, and I was hoping that that was going to develop into a really nice blindness story and that she might get a guide dog because she was very fond of dogs, but it never happened.
That's right. They didn't expand on that. And we haven't had too many blindness-related stories in the different serials that we have over here. And we do have quite an abundance of them, I have to say, particularly on television. But there you are. Yes, The Archers used to be a favourite programme of mine. I must admit, I haven't had time recently to listen to it. But
I can't imagine I've never having time for The Archers.
Sorry?
I just can't imagine, you know, my life ever being so busy that I didn't have time for The Archers.
Well, I used to be very fond of it, and I've got lots of archive materials from the 50s, 60s and 70s from The Archers, and I've been to recordings of it and met the characters and so on. It was really quite something I was into at one time.
Hmm. You and I will have to exchange archival material, perhaps.
That'd be a good idea.
Well, it's very nice of you to ring in, Maureen, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a good evening. Look, she's gone. Look, listen to this. Oh, look at that.
There we are.
We're just about out of time, Brian, but there. I was wondering where you think InfoTech will be heading in the future. What are the trends that you see emerging in the technology sector right now?
Well, obviously, screen reading is playing, you know, quite an important part, and you know, we'll obviously be keeping up to date with those developments, and also things like the Braille Note are very exciting, obviously, and that's really good. Hopefully, we'll be looking at those in the near future. But also, I'm very interested in some of the games, for instance, that you've been talking about on Main Menu, particularly the one produced by Babisoft. I think that's a really ambitious project and a very interesting one. Always as a child, I was frustrated, if you like, that there were games, obviously, that my brother could play, you know, by using a console attached to the television, for instance, that I was unable to play as a visually impaired person. And so games like the Grizzly Gulch Western Extravaganza from Babisoft can only be good news for blind people. I really do think that. And of course the talking book whole scenario, the DAISY format and everything that goes along with that is a very exciting development for us here in the UK, and I'm very looking forward to getting books available in that format. As an avid reader myself, it's going to be, you know, really good. There's a lot of exciting technology about at the moment. Mobile phones are becoming more accessible to blind and partially sighted people, and you'll hear a feature on InfoTech within the next couple of weeks about how they're becoming more accessible. And I just feel really proud to think that I'm living in such an exciting technological age and can benefit enormously from this technology.
Yes, Charlie Crawford and I were talking about that yesterday, and I was, you know, he was saying 100 years ago, imagine where we'd have all been. When is the RNIB starting to roll out its DAISY books to the public?
Well, they say it should be sometime next year. They're busy away, working away archiving them at the moment. So we should start to see some, I believe, perhaps this time next year. I'm not really sure, but I'm sure it's going to be next year at some point, and that's obviously going to be really good.
Yeah, but certainly not 10 years from now.
No, not at all. No.
No. All right. Well,
I'm very pleased actually that I'm in the United Kingdom, and I understand all. I'm glad you've asked me about that really, because I've been wanting to phone into Blind Line for a while. About this, I'm really pleased to be in the United Kingdom, and to be in a fortunate position that we are actually going to have easy to access books perhaps sometime next year. We're always encouraged to look up to people from the United States because they're so ahead as far as technology is concerned, and it seems rather a shame and disappointing to think that you guys are going to have to wait about 10 years to get the same access to books that perhaps we're going to have next year. But I do understand that it is a massive undertaking. I was listening to an extract from the convention the other week, and there was someone speaking on there. I forget his name now, but he was saying how much of a big undertaking it was. That's right. About 700,000 recipients of that particular library, and considering that our largest library probably has about 60,000, you know, it's a whole different ball game altogether. But it's good technology nonetheless, and I'm looking forward to it.
It is, and it's also relative. I mean, the distribution channels are larger, but they have the budget to match as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's been fascinating. We could talk for a lot longer about other issues we haven't touched on, so we'll have to get you back on the program. Are you going to go to sleep now, or are you staying up for the duration?
No, I'm actually going to get some sleep now because I've got quite a busy day ahead, so I ought to get at least a couple of hours.
I certainly appreciate you being a part of it at this dreadful hour, Brian. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show, and I love listening to the InfoTech program, so we'll keep in touch and keep up the great work.
Thank you. Can I just quickly say that coming up on InfoTech tomorrow, we're going to have a review of the Kurzweil 1000 version 5. That's the latest version on the market at the moment. And next week it will be our Site Village special. We'll be having a wander around the exhibition stands.
Did you take your mini-disc?
I got someone else to do the work for me.
Oh, well, that's delegation for you. Very good. Thank you for coming on the show, Brian. We'll keep in touch.
Thank you very much. It's really great to have been on Blind Line this evening.
Yes, indeed, and this afternoon where I am. We'll catch you later.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Brian Hutchin from the United Kingdom, host of the InfoTech program and, of course, the proprietor, I guess that's the term, is it, or presenter of the InfoTech magazine. You're listening to Blind Line on ACB Radio Mainstream, and if you're listening to it live, it's now 2:08 Universal Time. That's 8 minutes past 10 in the evening Eastern Time on a Wednesday night, 8 past 7 Pacific. And you're welcome to give us a call over the next 50 minutes or so and talk about anything that you would like to discuss. We got so wrapped up with Mike last week, we didn't have a chance for an open forum, so this is your opportunity now to catch up. Courtesy of spiderphone.com, our number is 1-212-812-2800. And then enter the PIN 1083-4173. So those details again, and they should be displayed in the window title bar of your player, but I'll give them to you again just in case. It's 1-212-812-2800 and enter the PIN 1083-4173, and you're most welcome to get in touch with us and have a chat with us on Blind Line. Now, Joseph Norton, good evening to you.
Hi there. I just thought I would call in. Enjoyed the presentation thus far with the gentleman from the UK. His name escapes me.
Brian Hutchin.
Page automatically crashed. Yeah, that's right. Is it my imagination? A web page automatically refresh.
I'm sorry, I missed the question. What was that?
Is it my imagination? Or did my web page all working at the spider phone web page? Does that automatically refresh, or you have to refresh it?
No, it automatically refreshes itself when a new call comes in.
Picking up. At any rate, something I if you'd mind or not, thought if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to give a plug for my Linux tutorial that I put up.
Yes, by all means. In fact, we were looking at, you were quite happy for us to run bits of that on main menu, is that right?
I hadn't really thought too much about it. I think I saw a comment from Matt that I think feed it over to you, but that's certainly a possibility if you'd like to do it. I haven't given it a whole lot of thought, but if you want to get me off time, we could probably talk about it.
We'll get in touch. But anyway, for those who want it before then, tell us about it by all means.
Basically, when SpeakUp started take off, as it were, I decided that audio or how to install the sections of Linux with the SpeakUp screen reader software. So what I did was just basically get some equipment together, had a little about from the sizer up to the mixer and the recorder, the tape deck on the other side of it, and basically just went and recorded myself and talking about what I was doing. I don't know if you'd had a chance to listen to it yourself at all, but
I haven't yet. It's on my to-do list.
Oh, that's your to-do list. But it's not the most professional first that you've ever heard, I'm certain of. What with the limitations of equipment I had, there are a few P-Hops and also some other things that the tape deck produced that I didn't know about later on, and clean some of that up, because I've got some need to get some hard drive space. One thing I found out in preparing this thing, work with sound can take a lot of hard drives.
Yeah, that's precisely why I work with a 30 gig drive.
Yeah, I think I've got a 6.4, and I understand that even the larger ones are coming down in price, so that's probably an investment I need to look at. Also, a better sound card, considering also, though. About the tutorial, you will notice that it uses a double talk speech synthesizer. And so, some people double talk as others, but it seems double talk is a balance between some speech synthesizers and a more expensive one.
And so where can people find the tutorial if they want to take a listen?
There are two places. It's on the Speak site, and you can go to the video page, and the link is www.speakup.org. I'll spell that linux-speakup. Also, put the tutorial on some website that I had. You can reach it by going to www.nortcom, that's NORTCOM, it stands kind of short for Norton Communications, nortcom.org.
That's excellent. Now, we are getting a bit of breakup here, but that's linux-speakup.org for people who want to, and of course they can have a hunt around and look at the Linux SpeakUp screen reader and a lot of information that's there as well.
Again, if you go to www.nortcom.org, to the main SpeakUp webpage and the tutorial for the download, if you want to download the themselves, there's a separate link off for that in case they're getting work breakups or whatever. Or they will stream using HTTP protocol, kind of like the Shoutcast streaming, but probably not as good. But thought I'd just give it kind of a plug in for it. It's not professional quality necessarily, or not as good as it could be, but I plan to rectify that hopefully in the near future. But interested in installing Linux, synthesizer decided to start talking. Anyone could certainly benefit from SpeakUp in action. So
did you actually record the tutorial under Linux?
What was that?
Did you actually record the tutorial under Linux using some sort of software under Linux?
No, I used to record most. I used GoldWave you digitize it and get it edited somewhat where I could put the introduction and the conclusion on it.
Okay, excellent. Oh, well, I hope people check that out, and I really appreciate you giving us a call and telling us about it.
Okay, and I hope that you and the family are doing well, and have a good afternoon.
Thank you. You too. Have a good evening. It's Joseph giving us a call to tell us about his Linux tutorial. And you can give us a call too if you would like, courtesy of spiderphone.com. Our number here on Blindline is 1-212-812-2800. That's 1-212-812-2800. And then the PIN is 1-083-4173. That PIN number, 1-083-4173. It's the Blind Line Show, and there are a number of things that you may like to talk about that have been happening over the last little while, including the AOL NFB decision today, an announcement via press release that there has been a settlement. There will not be any court action being taken. And what essentially appears to be going on is that AOL is saying that its AOL software version 6 will be screen reader friendly, and the NFB have said, well, on that basis we are withdrawing the lawsuit, and we reserve the right to come back in a year if things haven't been satisfactorily dealt with. We will in fact on main menu be speaking to somebody from AOL, and we might be able to do some other stuff about that as well, so stay tuned to main menu for coverage of this decision. Area code 917, hello. Hello, area code 917.
Hello.
Hi there. Speak to me.
Hello.
Who have we got there? Okay, fine. They've gone. After all of that, I'm not sure, there might be a bit of breakup on the old internet this afternoon. Sometimes the internet does things like that. But that's what makes this live radio business fun. And if you would like to attempt to get in touch with us, well, our number again is 1-212-812-2800. And then the PIN 1-083-4173. So yeah, we'll be speaking with somebody from AOL about the ramifications of this. And we'll be talking about the accessibility policy that, as part of the settlement, has also been agreed to by AOL. I don't think it's up on their website yet. I had a bit of a look for it this morning, and in recording the interview with the AOL gentleman, I think it's yet to be posted. But it is going to be posted, this AOL accessibility policy. And it's an important thing, because I guess the focus has been on the AOL software to actually use the provider that is AOL. But AOL's reach extends a lot broader than that these days. With the AOL Time Warner merger, of course, you've got AOL stretching into the cable business and a whole lot of things like that. And it can be pretty jolly frustrating when you purchase your cable box and you get that remote control and you find all the fancy on-screen programming features and things, and they're totally inaccessible. So it'd be nice to think that some attention to accessibility will be paid in that regard. Then, of course, there are other software products and websites that AOL control. I'm thinking of the Instant Messenger, ICQ. It's funny that they own both of those, ICQ and AOL Instant Messenger. One of the most famous examples is Spinner.com, the music site, which is notorious for being a bit troublesome, and other things as well. So, you know, assuming that they have been woken up, have been given a wake-up call with respect to accessibility, it could be significant. But then, you know, AOL may well argue, and we heard this when we covered the story in November of last year, that they were already doing this kind of work anyway, that they'd entered into non-disclosure agreements with screen reader manufacturers, and then what we're seeing now is simply the culmination of what would have happened anyway. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. I have seen little traffic on lists today talking about this, which surprises me. I thought there might have been a bit of speculation, a bit of comment coming forward as to whether this is a victory for NFB or a capitulation for them, a victory for AOL or a capitulation for them, what the story is, or is it a good compromise? Has sanity won out and everybody's won some and chose to sacrifice some? Who's got any view on what it all means, if anything? Give us a call. And of course, in Washington, D.C., over the last week, they have been celebrating on two counts, and we mustn't forget this. We did the interview with Charlie Crawford yesterday, but this is the first chance that people might have had to comment on this. Celebrating the fact that DVS is going to be a reality, this is a pretty significant decision. It is saying that by the year 2002, that the major networks are going to be required to provide 4 hours of content every week that is described. Good news or not? I would have thought so. I would have thought that this is an issue, a fundamental issue about access to information, and that it's interesting that it has taken so long for this important victory to have been won, when you consider how long captioning for the deaf has been a reality. So great work to all of those involved. You might have a view on that. Is there a type of programming that you would prefer to see described over another type of programming? What type of video programming, TV programming, do you find most difficult to follow? You might have some thoughts on that. Give us a call and chat with us on Blind Line, or I shall play you some music. They're also celebrating in Washington over the last week 10 years of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that's a pretty significant thing as well. What does that mean for you? Let's go to the phones now, though. We have a call on Blind Line. Hello there. Hello there.
Hello?
Hi, who are we talking to?
Yeah, I'm dealing with the here. I installed this the one on the MSN Messenger.
I'm sorry, I'm having a lot of difficulty hearing you. Are you there? Okay, we might have to flag that one. It's possible that I think we've got a bit of a bad connection here, so I'm going to just re-establish the connection and see if that helps us. Sometimes this happens with the wonderful old internet, so we'll just take a quick break for... No, we won't do that. We won't do that. We'll just see if we can get back in here. You're listening to ACB Radio, and we're going to be encouraging your phone calls very shortly once we get everything organized. We'll just dial back into the system in just a second. Now, tomorrow, I must tell you, before I tell you about what's going on tomorrow, next week we're going to be introducing the first of our three-hour days, and we hope to gradually be expanding all of our programs to 3 hour days, but we're going to be introducing Jeremy Hartley's program called Whole Note, and that is a program exclusively for blind musicians.
Welcome to spiderphone.com. Please enter your conference code now.
We seem to have some glitches on the net today, so if we can't get in, we'll have to abandon it and play some music. But anyway, as I was saying, Jeremy Hartley's program, Whole Note, is going to be on at 7 o'clock Eastern. Sorry, 8 o'clock Eastern. 8 o'clock Eastern. On next Thursday. So that's not tomorrow, but the week after that. And that will be a weekly hour-long program dedicated to the interests of blind musicians. And I know that will be a popular program. We'll just try this one more time.
Tom, please, conference call.
As you can hear, there's a lot of breakup. So I think we're going to have to flag the call-in portion of the program. But what we might do instead is actually go to... the out of sight chat and see if people want to chat to us in there. And at least I'm pleased that it held out for Brian Hartgen, who was kind enough to stay awake or right through the night pretty much for us. So we'll just go into the out of sight chat room and see if that can help us. We've got a bit of neck congestion, and hopefully the out of sight voice chat will allow us to continue. If you'd like to give us a call, what you need to do is go to www.outofsight.org.nz and then choose the join in our interactive voice chat link, and you'll be in, which is what I'm doing right now. And we'll be glad to have a chat to you there if you wish to. It seems to attract a different type of caller as well, you see, those who that prefer to use that instead of the regular phone and things. So that's fine. Give us a call at www.outofsight.org.nz.
Hello.
Hello there. Oh, I better hit the right key. Hi, we're on the blind line. How are you? That's a surprise, I'm sure. Well, I'm not sure, folks. We seem to be having either...
Hello?
Yep. Hi there, who are we speaking with?
Hello, this is Zeus.
Hi, this is Jonathan from ACB Radio, and you're on Blind Line. How are you?
Who am I speaking to?
This is Jonathan from ACB Radio, and you're on Blind Line, the international talkback show. This is fun, isn't it?
Am I?
Yeah. You are indeed.
Where am I?
I don't know. Where are you? This is fun. I told you that you could never...
What country am I in?
You're in Australia, by the sounds of it.
Australia. Yeah.
Well, if someone wants to come and join us, you're most welcome to do that. The address, if you'd like to come and have a chat to us on Blindline, is www.outofsight.org.nz, and then into the interactive voice chat. You're most welcome to do that, and we'll...
Jonathan, do they get many blind people there?
Your participation. In New Zealand?
On your site?
Oh, many, yes. And Dave, good evening to you.
Good evening, Jonathan. Good evening, world. Hello, everybody. This is Dave in Visalia, California. And I'd like to make a couple of comments, if I may, about visual description. First of all...
By all means, go ahead. What's your view on that now that the decision's been made?
So what time can I get on, Jonathan, to talk?
You're welcome to talk any time you wish. We're on Blind Line at the moment.
Yeah. I'd like to speak to somebody there that's blind.
You're doing that right now. Go ahead, Dave. What was your comment on video description?
Okay, I wanted to wait for her, didn't want to step on her toes there. My comment is simply this. I think we have such trash on TV in the United States. I don't know. I have very little faith in what they're going to broadcast. Last night, for example, what I would have really liked to get, and it would have been easy to visually describe, I had a show, there's a show on, it was a commentary on James Brown. And James Brown is, of course, the godfather of soul. I would love to have known who the people were that were being interviewed. I only recognized one of the DJs, Casey Kasem. I recognized his voice, but the others I didn't know. And so I really think that would have been a great boon to just have a little video description saying who the people are that were talking about this guy. Those kind of things I think would be really easy to visually describe. But we have so much stuff. I don't know. I'm not big on the sitcoms. Usually they're not dirty and sexy enough or violent enough for me. So I have to have the real. I don't know. I hope they find something. But I also think that the problem that we have is that we end up in this country, just going for the tripe issues. You know, blind people need employment. We need transport. We need a lot more things. Frankly, video description is a nice touch. but it doesn't make the real issue. At least that's my opinion, and I'll back off and get my soapbox down.
Well, it's a valid point of view. I wonder, though, whether, you know, there are certain programs that really are very difficult. I mean, I wonder how many of us can relate to when you're sitting in front of the television and watching a movie, and you've hung in right to the bitter end, and then you find that somebody's run off with someone else, and you're not quite sure what the outcome was, or whether they ran off hand in hand, or whether they ran in separate directions. And isn't it, in the end, you know, the same argument as captioning for the deaf, that it's access to information, that it's public information, and that we have a legitimate right to access that?
It is, and we have to understand that if you look at the captioning for the deaf, most of it is sponsored by the advertisers, and they say that audibly when you and most notably the news broadcasts. Channel 30, for example, in Fresno, our news captioning is sponsored by Joe's Widgets. That's maybe something we need to consider. I tend to be a little bit more. I shy away from getting the government involved in this thing unless we really have to. Go ahead.
Well, that's okay. I understand what you're saying. And are you saying that, like, it's an opportunity cost thing, that with for when people are putting energy and time into audio description, that it's time that could be spent advocating on other issues? Is that really the point?
Time and maybe money. Maybe money more than time, even. Advocating is one thing. But actually achieving, I think what happens is we need to let the sighted public know that, you know, access to information, access to life, access to society is not just watching movies. That's a nice touch, don't get me wrong. Not a big movie watcher. I like the old ones myself, the real old ones, and the Turner Classic Movies is already doing some of those. But I just think we need to get on the real track. We've gotten off the real track somewhere, and we need to look at the other real accessibility issues that are perhaps more important in the long run. Again, that's just this one man's opinion, and I've been shouted down before, so I'm used to it.
Well, not on this station you won't. I think there's room for all opinions, and I really appreciate you expressing it. It'll be interesting to see whether those who have opposed the DVS thing bother to take any kind of legal action through the appeals process. But thanks very much for dropping by. I really appreciate it, Dave. And keep tuned in. You're listening to Blind Line on ACB Radio, and if you'd like to participate in the show today, we're here for the next half hour or so. Our spiderphone.com service appears to, it's the Delta 3 actually that's letting me down. Spiderphone's working fine. So come and visit us at www.outofsight.org.nz, into the voice chat room, and you'll be on here on ACB Radio live on Blind Line. And Richard Costa, good evening to you.
Good evening, Jonathan. Always nice to hear you. And I have to say ditto to the last comments. I mean, I don't really see DVS as something really important. I think the one thing that could be important is definitely when you do get a warning, you know, when it scrolls across the screen.
Yes.
I could remember growing up is that they did break in and they did announce it. They didn't just scroll across the screen. So I think that's more of a common sense issue.
Well, absolutely. There seems to be a lot of enthusiasm for that. One of the things I mentioned to Charlie Crawford about yesterday, and it did come up at the ACB convention, was this whole issue of the advertising. The, you know, call this toll-free number now type thing. And they might spend, in some of these infomercials, you know, they can spend some considerable minutes hyping you up about a program. And they repeatedly say, call the number on your screen, and you never find out what it is. I would have hoped that might have been something that, not just for the US, of course, but for where I am too, that might be rectified at some stage in the future.
Hello, Jonathan.
Hello there.
I'd like to talk about some screen readers for the blind.
Yeah, by all means.
At the present time, I'm using JAWS and also using Dragon. And I was just wondering if there's been anything else looked into to help the blind.
You mean with respect to JAWS's compatibility with Dragon or other screen reading software?
Anything else that they've bought out?
Well,
there is SpeakUp for Linux.
Oh, give me a break. Oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. There is, if you want to go into Linux, yeah. I'm still skeptical about why anyone would, but people do. You can always go and have a look at, off the top of my head, you've got Window Eyes, which is an alternative. You can download a demo of that software from their website. You could also get HAL by Dolphin, Window Bridge from Synthavoice, and Arctic WinVision. I'm just trying to think of other Windows screen readers I've left out, otherwise ProTalk from BioLink. So there are actually a large number of Windows-based screen readers you could have a play with. Most of them do have demos that allow you to use them to some degree for a few minutes or so before they stop working.
Yeah, well, see, my problem is that I'm totally blind and I can't see the keyboard, so I have to have the program that the voice program to talk into it, and then Joyce does the reading for me. But I would also like to learn the do the commands by typewriter, by keyboard. Is there anything available like that?
Well, I'm sure that all of us who are here at the moment, I'm totally blind as well, and most of us type, you know, extremely fast. So it's just a case of trying to access the training that you need to learn to touch type. And once you've acquired that skill, you know, there's no difficulty, because when you think about it, a secretary who touch types, for instance, is typing so fast that they're not looking at the keys. So, you know, all of us who are in here right now are all blind people and are using the keyboard to access Windows.
So how do I use the keyboard to get onto the internet? What commands and all this type of thing? Is there something that can help me?
Sure. If you've got JAWS, you should have received a series of training tapes that comes with JAWS, and if you're able to sit down and go through those, they not only introduce you to JAWS as a screen reader, but also to Windows as an operating system. And, you know, you can also get training from various sources as well. One of the things that JAWS and a number of other screen readers have is a keyboard learn feature, so that when you turn that on, because you're a JAWS user, in that case it's insert and the number one, you hold down the insert key, the big bottom right hand corner on the number pad key, and press the number one, and then every key you press identifies itself without actually taking its action, so that way you can learn exactly what the keys do and what their function is. So that's quite a useful way of doing it. But there are talking typing tutorial programs that will allow someone to come up to speed if they've never used a keyboard before. Yeah.
Righto then, thanks very much for that, Jonathan. I'll go through those training tapes. I haven't had a chance to do it yet.
Yeah, do that and see what you think. It's been a long time since I've heard the training tapes, and they've been updated since I ever heard them. But people talk about them quite favourably these days, so you might find that will really get you moving. And I'll be interested to hear how you get on. But yeah, good luck. And it definitely is possible for you to master the keyboard even when you can't see it, and you'll be tapping away in no time, I'm sure. I wish you all the very best of luck. I actually just lost track of the order that people were in. Richard, were you saying something when just before there?
yes, I was. I was saying that when you were saying about giving the number in the commercial, it, again, it just boils down to common sense. I mean, you would think that it's not a difficult thing to do. It's just this, you know, just would think as an advertiser that that would definitely be a good idea, because it, not only do they see it visually, but they hear it.
Yeah, well, let's hope that sanity prevails at some point. Absolutely. There was something I was going to ask you. Oh yeah, you've got your SoundForge 4.5G, your SoundForge XP. You enjoying that?
I haven't done too much with it yet. I'm going to be trying to play with it. Yes. The one portion I do have a question about is when you set in the video area, it's the last tab that you come to in properties. Windows seems to be giving me some kind of an error message, but I'm not getting any kind of an error message. So at least Joe isn't telling me what the error message is, and I can't quite figure it out.
Yeah. Windows is wonderful, isn't it? Yeah. Mind you, each operating system has its quirks, but that's right. I'll just bring Michael off in and see if his audio is working. Hello, Michael, is your audio working?
Well, I certainly hope it is, and I guess you'll let me know otherwise, but I guess the topics of the day are DDS, AOL, and NLS. First, make sure you can hear me okay.
Yeah, I just had to turn you up because Richard was very loud and you're not quite set up, but that's fine, that's my issue. Yeah, DVS, NLS, and what was the other one? Anyway, it's all acronyms. What are your views on these topics?
Well, first, as far as DVS and mandating of, 4 hours a day, I think it's going to be a good idea. I was first concerned that it could be the worst 4 hours of the day. But I think that's a good idea. It'll allow production companies, people who make the programs, will put the descriptive audio in from the beginning. So we'll see a greater deployment, and I'm sure our friends in Boston will be quite busy on that. As far as AOL, I'm always glad when something comes out of GW Micro saying they've got a product to work. I thought that perhaps in a year or so this may not be a big issue, and it justifies, for those who believe that NFV action was necessary, to help get the ball rolling, and unfortunately we have to do that sometimes to mandate access. As far as the NLS, my view is I don't see why they can't get rolling on the players themselves, along with all productions in digital by October 1 of 2003. And with 700,000, it seems like they would have the marketing power to go out and get the unit they want. And if they want a Victor, a Plex Talk, or a more advanced unit. Maybe I'll ask you, since you actually played with the Victor, if it can, on its simplest form, accommodate someone who wants to do nothing other than just plug in a device.
Well, I listened to the interview that Jim Layton did, the very excellent interview that he did with the folks from NLS, and made a series of notes about that. I was interested that, you see, it seems to me that the fundamental difference here is the delivery mechanism. I think that probably the result of the NISO standard process will be some sort of merger of the two standards. I hope so. I mean, that will be a good thing for everybody concerned, because the last thing that people want is competing standards. That would be a disaster in such a niche market like talking books. But I suppose what I've found interesting is this whole debate about whether the CD is an inappropriate delivery mechanism. And, it's, I suppose, a judgment call, isn't it, that NLS have made, and they've done the research, and they believe that that's the appropriate thing to have done. However, the Daisy books are being rolled out by, I guess, the middle of next year, end of next year. You'll see RFBND start to bring those out. And I think that there will probably be a considerable pressure from the consumers at that point, and it may not be too late. Perhaps there will be a change of personnel in due course, and maybe it will be relatively easy for NLS to, once they've got the digital production side of it going, to reverse this decision and go on to the Daisy for the CD and the DAISY format. I think you're right about the economies of scale issue, that they've got enormous power with that large consumer base that they have there. But I also found it remarkable that the argument was being put forward that the Plex Talk and the Victor were too fragile because they were a CD player and all of the laser mechanisms and things that could potentially be damaged. I mean, one wonders how on earth businesses that sell over the internet shipping CD products survive, and I really found that a remarkable argument.
Yeah, well, as far as the CD, I don't rule out looking for maybe even a technology like the DVD that might hold 20 gigabytes or 30 times the capacity. I mean, imagine you could put a variety of collections together, say, for those who enjoy bestsellers or all writings from a particular author. But I suspect, I have to wonder if part of this desire to have an individual card is to accommodate the publishing industry and the authors and in their thoughts and attempt to prevent the replication of the works. Yeah, I'm concerned, you know, Victor and Plex, it might not be the ultimate device, but I'd like to see something that is plug and play for those who need that, just comes on and does its thing beginning to end, or can have the advanced features. I'd like to see the NLS produce an increased number of what to me would be more useful materials that would promote employment, education, training opportunities, and specific information on areas you know, of employment that we might benefit on. Just my personal thought there.
Yes, all good points. And there's an interesting convergence going on, because if you look at the technology such as the DVD, which will be able to store larger amounts of data, and then you look at audio compression, which is getting better and better. I know that both DAISY and the NLS people are very keen to continue a commitment to open standards, which is absolutely right, in my humble opinion anyway. You're now looking at this new Vorbis standard, for instance, for audio, which is completely open source. Nothing proprietary about it. And the audio compression, the sound of that compression is remarkable. So you may eventually, you know, if we're talking 4 or 5 years down the track, be able to look at 16K MP3 type compression or 16K compression using some standard either being developed now or yet to be developed. And if you have, say, 7 megabytes an hour, which is what you would get with 16K compression on a 20 gig capacity disk, I mean, imagine the number of books that you could put on one disc. It will be fantastic.
Oh, definitely. And they seem to be currently looking at 32-bit, at least from the numbers they use. But have you got that Vorbis to work? I put up a stream I thought was a variable bit rate from 128 down to 16, but I have not gotten it to play locally, so if you've had luck, or maybe they've updated the software. I got one of the very first betas they've done with that, which I use a Lame encoder, I think, which is very interesting. I like that for MP3 as well. Would love this technology, and I won't keep you if you got other folks you want to get into the mix, but very interesting developments. I heard today there's an implementation put out with Linux and the new Bluetooth technology for wireless. So when you laugh about Linux, remember it's going to become deployed on a greater level because of its ingenuity. And it's nice that we will have some access to it. And if it's free, that's great. And I mean, Kirk and the geniuses that are working on that project, it's pretty awesome.
Well, I agree with you. And in all seriousness, it's a personal preference thing for me. I wouldn't want to go back to a command line interface. Wouldn't do it for anything. But it's really important that we do have access to whatever people choose to use. And we should have the freedom to access this kind of operating system and any other, not only to be competitive in the workplace, but to give us as much choice as anyone else. And I do love the culture. Well, now I love bits of the culture of the Linux community. I love the part of the culture that, you know, the whole general public license thing and the way they're willing to share and improve on each other's work, and that's a great part of the culture. There's another part of the culture that's a bit sort of, I can't even think of the term I'm looking at to describe, looking for to describe the culture. Elitist, I guess, you know, you sort of, let's make things as hard as possible to use, and we're happy. But I agree with you. Linux has definitely got a place, and I really appreciate you popping in, Michael. We'll keep in touch. And the next person on my list doesn't have a name. They've come in as a guest, so we'll say hello to you. Actually, they've gone, and Joseph is next. I'm sorry, Joseph. If I knew you were here, I wouldn't have been so rude about Linux.
Now let's see. Is my audio breaking up here or anything? I've never tried this with Window Eyes running here. I'm holding the F9 key.
And you're doing just great.
Oh, okay. One thing I might stress too is that with Linux, although right now the majority of the access to Linux is done with a command line, that may not be the way it will be always. There are folks already working on the X Windows environment, and more sound cards are being supported in Linux, so who knows, one day you may be doing the exact same thing in Linux, or you may be able to do the exact same thing in Linux that you're doing right now with Windows. So I wouldn't necessarily say that it's all going to be command line. More and more things are going to X, and it's going to be something that we will all have to face sooner or later, but the command line is good for those who like to hack and tinker around. One thing I thought about, Jonathan, you may want to give your thoughts on this, with regard to using the DAISY technology and using the CDs, with a lot of folks I know that it probably wouldn't be too big of an issue, but have there been any field tests as far as just mailing CDs around the country, having them handled by all kinds of different users, dropped, and what about little kids that are using this technology? Because it could be argued that kids will be using this technology pretty soon as well.
Yeah, just coming back to your point about X Windows, it's a very good one, and I follow with interest any efforts that people are making to make the X Windows environment accessible, because I think that is exciting, the idea that you can work in this lovely graphical environment without being inhibited by necessarily all of the Microsoft constraints and having a choice. That is very groovy. There was a comment in the NLS interview that that Jim Layton did that we were playing in the last 24 hours, that they were concerned about the ability of older people to handle the CDs because of dexterity issues. And of course it really is important to always keep in mind that the majority of blind people are elderly, and so it's important that any new program is not developed at the expense of those of the majority, and obviously NLS is very much aware of that. I don't know about the actual rigors of mailing things from one person to another, and whether you'd need some sort of more robust delivery mechanism than the dual case. One of the options, of course, is to develop a player that uses a kind of a cartridge system in which the CD is stored, so that people never actually have to encounter the physical disc, that it's in a cartridge. And I know a lot of radio stations use this. Denon made a player, obviously, for the broadcast industry. But that might be an option that people may want to consider at some point.
Yeah, did you ever see the old RCA video disc? Did you ever see one of those?
I don't think I did. Tell me about that.
I wish I knew more about the technology and how it worked. The disc was actually, you bought the disc and it had its own album cover, and the album cover had a little plastic, well it wasn't so little, the disc was a pretty big thing. The album cover had this insert that was in it and snapped into it that had the video disc in the middle of all this. When you slid the album cover into the machine, you actually took the whole thing and slid it into the machine. It was a rather big thing, and the machine grabbed it from you and pulled it in, unsnapped the insert from within the album cover and gave you back the album cover, keeping the disc, and then the disc spun up. The first time I heard it spinning up, I thought it was it started off kind of like, but I thought it was a motorcycle in the movie or something starting, but it really was just the disc spinning up. But somebody told me it actually used grooves to store the information. I don't know how it did it. The player seemed to be rather good. I was able to bump it a little bit and it didn't skip, but that's possibly a thought, although that would be a rather, that would make the player more complicated, or at least possibly would.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, to make the interface as simple as possible, at least in one particular player. But anyway, Joseph, I just got time to go to Tim, who's waiting in the wings here, and then it will be time for us to go. So nice to hear from you, and we'll look forward to further discussion about your tutorial. And good evening to you, Tim. Now, if I remember rightly, Massachusetts is your part of the world, is that right?
Yes, and I guess my GhostWave demo on main menu generated, I haven't been on the PC audio list, but I hear the GhostWave SoundForge wars keep raging on, Jonathan.
No, actually, it's been won by SoundForge. The most ardent proponent of GhostWave, Patrick Perdue, who you may have heard of, has openly gone on the PC audio list and admitted that he's investigated SoundForge and he was wrong.
All right. Well, I'll have to. I may have to take a look at SoundForge. I think they're both very good. I think they're both very good programs, and it's good that we have so much choice within the whole, sound audio technology field in terms of recording.
No, actually, in all seriousness, if it works for you, that's the important thing. And I think that what actually happens is that I would say that if someone is starting from scratch, I would recommend SoundForge, because especially if they have a knowledge of Windows preceding the use of SoundForge in terms of selection and things, because it uses standard keyboard commands. But, you know, for those who've gotten into it and mastered it, GhostWave is absolutely fine. It does a lot of stuff, and it's a very good price, and it does make an effort at noise reduction, which the only way that you can get that feature in SoundForge is to buy the full SoundForge, which is not cheap, and then buy its DirectX plugin. So that is an advantage. You're absolutely right. It's good to have choice. And in the end, what counts is what comes out the other end. And I must admit, I was really impressed with some of the stuff that you were doing in that GhostWave piece on main menu. So you've obviously got it very much, very much sussed.
Oh, thank you very much. When I demoed that at Vibug, some people were wondering. But I just want to let you know, I have ventured into the world of mini disc and just purchased last week a MZR-37 Sony mini disc recorder. So if there's any of your listeners out there that can have any tips on how to use it, I'd be happy to hear from people.
Well, I don't know how similar yours is to the one I have, which is the MZR-70, but I love it. You know, I can do editing and all sorts of stuff. You might have heard Brian Hartson earlier, we were talking about this. It's not as reliable as, say, editing with a screen reader on your PC, where you get all sorts of confirmation and verification. But it is possible to do editing and to delete tracks and things. The reason why I bought the 70 is because it doesn't have the jogging wheel, and I find that getting that weird out of the equation helps considerably.
Well, it's interesting because I have some friends who have the 50, which they love, and that has the jog wheel. So it really, I have to say, though, I'm very impressed with the sound. We're going to start recording our Vibug meetings coming up next month using the mini disc. So I'm pretty excited about it. So we're making another step up the audio ladder here.
Oh, it's great sound. It really is. Yeah, to my ears, it's CD quality, and I know that there's some compression going on, but it's pretty good stuff. Well, you've rounded off the show for us, Tim, because I'm going to have to log off. But it's always nice to hear your considered opinions, and keep up the great work at Vibug. Actually, I'm sure you've probably got quite a bit of stuff that I should talk to you about lending to main menu, because you seem to have some great stuff that goes on in your part of the world.
Yeah, we have some neat stuff coming up. Next month, we're going to be doing a whole, in August, we're going to be doing a whole games day, so we'll be covering a lot of the games that you covered here on main menu, including Grizzly
Grizzly Gulch and some others. So, yeah, I'll keep in touch with you, and of course I'll keep sending you the council connections as well.
Yeah, we always look forward to that. So that's great. Well, we'll catch you again and have a wonderful evening.
So you too, Jonathan, and keep up the great work.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That's Tim Cummings from Massachusetts and Bybuck, and that's where we leave you. Well, we got there, you see. A bit of internet breakup in the middle there and a few false starts, but it was great to hear Brian Hartson. Really interesting man. And don't you love that accent? Don't you love it? I know Americans love that accent. Have a wonderful evening. Be back next week. Bye for now.
If you'd like to keep up to date with what's happening on ACB Radio, join our announcements list. You'll receive messages from ACB Radio staff about feature programs, scheduled outages, and website additions. To join this announcements-only email list, send a blank email to acbradio-announce-subscribe@egroups.com. That's acbradio-announce-subscribe@egroups.com. Stay in touch with ACB Radio, the station that's out of sight.